Laura Poitras is a Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Her latest is called My Country, My Country. It's one of four documentaries about the war in Iraq that's contending for an Oscar nomination this year. The film looks at the question of whether it's possible to conduct democratic elections in a war zone. The documentary really took shape in Poitras's mind when she visited the Abu Ghraib prison, 20 miles west of Baghdad.
They gave me permission to film an inspection that was being conducted by a group of Iraqis, led by Dr. Riyad, who became the focus of the film. So he comes to the prison, I was there, and I introduced myself as an American documentary filmmaker, and I asked him if I could film him during the inspection, put a microphone on him and film him.
And you had not met him before?
Hadn't met him, and I was still looking for the characters, you know, that were going to become the film. I mean, the type of work I do is cinema verite, which, you know, for your listeners is telling stories through characters as things unfold. It's, you know, generally not using interviews, but following action as it happens. And so I said I was an American filmmaker, and he said, please, you know, we want transparency, and we want the world to know what's happening here. So then I filmed him, and I filmed him at the prison for about 2 hours, and there was about 2,500 men being detained at the prison at the time. And so he was talking to the men across, you know, razor wire and fence, and, you know, many of them had been there for over a year without any official charges. And then he's turning around and trying to explain to the U.S. military what the problems were. And, you know, one of the scenes that's in the film is when they discover a 9-year-old boy who's being held there.
A nine-year-old boy.
And so he turns around and he explains to the U.S. soldier who's running the prison, you know, why that it's not okay to have a 9-year-old at Abu Ghraib prison.
This is type of punishment.
Yes.
This type of punishment, they can't bear it because they are children.
We have looked through every one of these files. These juveniles are dangerous.
And there was something in this conversation where you have an Iraqi turning around to, you know, explain to an American, you know, some basic, you know, principles of what is morally right and wrong. And he was just a great character.
Yeah, I can see why you began to find him appealing. What did you do next? Did you realize right then that this was the focus of your film?
Yeah, I mean, the type of filmmaking I do, you kind of get those kinds of instincts where, like, you know that this is something that, you know, it's a really, really special. And then he invited me to come to his medical clinic, which is in the neighborhood of Adamiya, which is a Sunni neighborhood. And he had a free medical clinic where people would come and bring their physical problems and then also, you know, talk about the situation, you know, the political situation. And as I was filming there, you know, if I had any doubts about, you know, him as really an extraordinary character, they evaporated. And what was really tremendous is that, you know, this was during a time when I was filming where very few Iraqis would even agree to go, you know, on record with print media, let alone have a camera follow them. And yeah, he ultimately invited me to stay in his home so I would live with him and his family and shoot.
This is very different from what you expected, I imagine, when you went to,
it is,
to
yeah,
Baghdad. I mean, you were going to be in the green zone. You were going to be following more or less the official line. This is something completely different.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be a film much more about America in Iraq, and which it still is. I really feel it is a film about the, you know, the American occupation of Iraq, but it's really told from an Iraqi perspective. And I think it would have been pretty unrealistic of me going in to think that I would have gotten the kind of access to a Sunni family that I ultimately did. Yeah. And I knew that once I had that access, that it was pretty extraordinary, because there aren't many journalists who, you know, have been able to get into the homes. And also, to being a woman allowed me to film the dynamics in the family between the doctor and his wife and daughters.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is that we hear so much about how American journalists are unable to get out of the green zone and into a family. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Didn't you have any trouble with the authorities?
Well, first of all, I would say that actually there aren't many journalists inside the green zone, actually very, very few. I was one of the few people who actually had the kind of access I did. They're mostly living on compounds, protected compounds, but outside the green zone. They're not living in the green zone. But they also have been confined because of security situations to often their hotels or, you know, working with security. And I mean, there were certainly definite risks involved in terms of the way I worked, which was really to travel alone in the company of Dr. Riyad or members of his family. But it also allowed me to really be very discreet in terms of moving in the city. So, you know, the precautions I took were, you know, I always wore a headscarf. And I also always, you know, the footage that I shot at Abu Ghraib, I always carried with me, because I felt that if I gotten myself in a bad situation. It was something that I could use to demonstrate what, you know, the work that I was doing.
Who else did you go see? Who were you searching for?
The film is, I mean, the story of the doctor, who is, he is someone who's very critical of the U.S. occupation, but also decides to run for local office. So the real thread of the story is him as a protagonist and the election process. And as part of filming the elections, I also spend a lot of time filming the U.S. military and their preparations for it. So very high-level meetings, you know, in terms of elections preparations, where you see that most of the organization is, you know, a lot of the organizations and security is being conducted by the U.S. And then also the U.N. Electoral Assistance Committee that were brought there to work with Iraqis to administer the elections. And then I also spent time with a group of Australian contractors, security contractors, you know, guns for hire, who were brought in to protect election materials and drive them across the country. So I would travel with them as they went on convoys to move ballots and registration materials, you know, under heavy, heavy arms. And one of the scenes that's probably one of my favorite scenes in the film is the Australians buying guns, AK-47s, from a, you know, black market arms deal to protect election materials.
So the AK-47 normal, 200 to 250, where is it made? Which one?
We have Russian, also we have China.
Russian's better.
Of course.
Yeah. I would like to have my people test fire them first, eh? To make sure they work.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just to set the scene for the people who haven't seen your documentary yet, this is all leading up to the famous Purple Finger election.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And in fact, voter turnout for that, I mean, this is one of the great success stories, as the story was told here. Voter turnout in Iraq was higher there than ever here, as I understand it.
Yeah, the turnout was 58%, and that was with a Sunni boycott of the election. So, you know, people at great risk to their lives went to vote. And I think that's actually one of the, you know, lessons of the film, when we hear the U.S. administration and government talking about us bringing democracy to Iraq and the Middle East. And then you realize that, you know, not only did they turn out and vote, but they did it, you know, with death threats and at higher levels than we do in this country.
Yeah. Of course, there's been a lot of media about Iraq over the last few years. In fact, your film is one of four documentaries about the Iraq War contending for Oscars this year. Does that surprise you?
I don't think it's surprising. I mean, you know, I mean, as artists working in these times, I mean, this is a really pivotal, crucial event in U.S. history. So it's not surprising that there would be documentary filmmakers who'd be compelled to look at this war and to look at it in a different way than you're going to get from the local or the nightly news or the front page of the paper, but to really try to understand it in some kind of a way that has, you know, historical, I guess, depth.
Is that what you see as the role of the political documentary?
I mean, I really approach it as an artist, you know, making films. I mean, I went there as an American with a sense of despair about the war and wanting to express something about that. And as a documentarian, thinking that this is a war that's going to have repercussions for, you know, I think generations, and that it was pretty important to try to document what was happening now, you know, both to express something about it in the immediate and then in the longer term to have a document of it. So I think it's motivated more as an artist than as a quote-unquote political documentary.
Of course, you've obviously studied the art of the documentary. You've looked at a lot of them. You've seen what other people do. Do you see them as having changed over the years? Are political documentaries different now from what they used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a really great time for documentaries, because I think with success of certain films like Spellbound and Mad Hot Ballroom or Michael Moore's work, what you have is films that really are good stories, and people are going to see them and paying money in theaters to go and see them because they know that they're going to see a story like that they expected seeing a narrative film. And I think that documentaries now are a little bit less preachy and educational, where I think that they'd gotten a bit of a, you know, stuck in sort of a TV mode of, you know, like that they're good for you, but they're not actually very enjoyable experiences. And I think with the success of films in recent years, it's a really interesting time. And I think as a storyteller, to be able to tell stories that are not only significant politically, but also move people, is something you can do. And people are doing more and more of.
You risked your life to do this. Did you do that consciously?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I feel this is a war. This is our war. I mean, this is a war of choice. It's a preemptive war. Thousands of Americans have died in this war, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died. And I felt that it was just really crucial to be be able to have a history of it, and that the work that I do, I mean, I really feel like it's a privilege what I do. And the risk that I was seeing around me was so much greater than the risk that I was taking. But I think it's actually, we're living in times where, you know, it's not a time to sit back and let other people take sacrifices. I mean, if you can do something or say something, I think it's, you know, it's just a crucial time to do that.
What does the title mean? My country, my country. Where does that come from?
My country is Montani, Montani in Arabic, and it's the opening lines of the Iraqi national anthem. And it's sung in the film at one point when one of the doctor's daughters comes home on election day.
Ya watani sa'd sabahak lam nishamil lam lim jirahak.
Laura Poitras is a documentary filmmaker. Her latest film, My Country, My Country, is on the short list for feature-length documentaries for the Academy Awards.